And there was a quote that I found, and I knew I should have written down a note because I can't find it again.
Welcome to Geeks Without God with Molly Glover, Nick Glover, and Tim Wick.
We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, we're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks. Geeks Without God.
This week on Geeks Without God, we're recording remotely with Greta Christina to talk about her new book, The Way of the Heathen. It's available now, so go buy it. Go.
We're geeks. We're geeks. We're geeks without God. We're geeks. We're geeks. We're geeks without God. We're geeks. Geeks without God.
Welcome to Geeks Without God. I am your host, Molly Glover, joined as always by my co-hosts, Tim Wick.
Hello.
And Nick Glover.
That one's me.
And today we are very excited to be joined via Skype by Greta Christina. Hello, Greta.
Hi.
Greta's here to promote her new book, The Way of the Heathen, by Pitchstone Publishing. And she's also, this is your third time, I think, on the show, right?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, exciting, yes. Hi, how are you?
It's been a while, though. The first time was way back in, like, our first
2013.
20 episodes.
Yeah, yep.
So, it's been a while. Nice to have you back.
Oh, it's really nice to be back.
So, we were lucky enough to get advanced copies of your book, The Way of the Heathen, and we were reading through it, all of us. It's great. I really like it a lot. And so how would you, like, what's your elevator pitch for the book here?
Okay. So my elevator pitch for the book is, so you're an atheist, now what? You don't believe in God, either you used to be religious and now you don't anymore, or you just never believed in God. What does that mean for how you live your life? Believers and atheists, there's a lot of ways in which we're obviously the same. We're all human, but there are real differences in how you live your life when you don't believe in a deity whose purpose you're living out, when you don't believe in an afterlife, when you think this life is all there is and it's yours to create, it's yours to make meaning for, it's yours to decide what's good and what's bad, it's yours to try to make the world better. If the world is terrible, then it's our job to make it right because there's no deity who's going to do it for us.
Kidding.
Those are different ways of living. And I know that a lot of people, when they leave religion, this is a lot of what they struggle with. And from the years that I've been an out atheist, the years that I've been thinking and writing about these issues and talking with hundreds, thousands, really, of other atheists and other non-believers about these issues, that's sort of all of those years of thinking is condensed into this book.
Excellent.
One of the things, one of the things you mentioned in the book, towards the beginning, I want to say, like, second or third chapter in there, maybe, you said, like, your conclusions don't stand in a vacuum. They have implications. And so if your conclusion is that God doesn't exist, then, an implication of that is then we're responsible.
Exactly. And, there's a lot of people who want to say that and who do say that atheism doesn't mean anything other than not believing in gods. That's all it means, and that there's no point in trying to build atheist communities, or if you are building an atheist community or an atheist movement, it can't be about anything other than God not existing. Mm-hmm. And if you want to narrowly define atheism the way you want to, that's fine. I'm actually a big supporter of people defining this language in a way that works for them.
You actually get into that at the end of the book.
I do get into that. That's a whole other topic which we can get into if you want. But for me and for a lot of people I know, once I decided that there was no God and no supernatural world, that conclusion had implications. It changed the way I think and it changed the way I act in the world. Mm-hmm. And some people use the words humanism or the word skepticism to talk about that, to talk about, well, now that you don't believe in God, what does that mean? What kinds of thought processes about does it imply? How does it imply your relationship with reality? I personally like to use the word atheism as sort of an umbrella for all of that, for the lack of belief in gods and all of the things that that means to me in terms of how I live my life and what kind of community and movement I'm building.
Well, and I think I personally, When you come to the conclusion that you don't believe in God, if you come from a position where you were part of a religion and that religion defines certain moral decisions, you have to start asking the question, well, morally, what are my conclusions if there's no God driving those conclusions? And I think when you say, well, atheism just means you don't believe in God, well, that's fine, but there are implications to making that cognitive, reaching that cognitive conclusion.
Right. I mean, one of those, and this is something that you talk about in your How to Talk to Non-Believers, you know, who are grieving, but that the concept of, you know, when you give up on, I want to say give up on God, it makes it sound like we're, you know,
losing
but,
something.
Yeah, but when you realize, when you come to that conclusion of atheism, you are giving up the idea of heaven and an afterlife, and you're giving up the tranquility, I guess, that comes from knowing this isn't all there is, back to the reality that this is all there is. And I think for a lot of people, we make that, you know, live every day like it's your last, this is your only go-round, and that's where we draw a lot of our morality. You know, most atheists I know are against the death penalty, vehemently, for this reason, because this is all we get, so taking it away from someone is worse than any other punishment. And I think that it really means a lot that you do have to, the implication being that you gain a lot, but you lose a lot, and that sense of you have to kind of refine your equilibrium in terms of how you view the world.
Yeah, you do. And it's something that I feel like we don't need to do alone. When I left religion, and I was never a hardcore religious believer, but I had this sort of spiritual but not religious New Age Northern California mishmash.
Yeah, kind of religion. All three of us had that. We get that. Yeah. We just did an episode about pagan phases.
Yeah. And when I let go of that, I wasn't familiar with there being any sort of atheist or humanist or skeptical or non-belief community. And so I kind of had to make up a lot of the stuff on my own. And really, it became much easier when I did start to connect with other non-believers and talk through some of these ideas. Because you're right that when you let go of religion and, you know, you accept the conclusion of non-belief, it changes, in many cases, the specific opinions you have and the specific ideas you have, you know, such as, I used to believe that gay people were terrible, and now I don't think that because I don't belong to the church that believes that anymore. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this sort of meta, or I don't know, epistemological, I guess. There's a whole question of how do you even know? How do you even think about these things? You know, how do you decide? You know, and if you're used to a world where how you decide is the preacher tells me.
Right.
Then when you're on your own, it's like, how do we decide? And so it's like you come to different conclusions, but also your whole approach to how you think about it is different.
Do you think that, I mean, because atheists are, you know, a marginalized group, you know, a minority. I mean, we're getting more, but I would say that the concept of people who don't have religion is a little different than, you know, actual out atheists. Do you think that there are other groups that have a kind of analogous thing where, you know, they, when they kind of come out, as it were, they have this, you know, same amount of refooting to try to get, like, I mean, when, because, you know, if someone comes out gay, do they have to re-navigate the world in the same way that they did and find new community in the same way that they did when they, if they come out atheist, do you think?
In similar ways. I mean, I myself am bisexual, lesbian identified, bisexual, dyke, whatever you want to call that. Mm-hmm. And certainly for a lot of us, for a lot of TBLG people, we do have to rethink a lot of things when we accept our sexual identity or our gender identity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it isn't just a matter of, well, I guess I like girls.
Right.
Because that does change a lot of things. And it certainly changes things because we do live in a homophobic, biphobic, transphobic world. And so you have to figure out how to navigate that. But it also, it doesn't always do this, but it often, it changes the way we think about gender. It changes the way we think about family. It changes, you know, the way that we think about, you know, love and relationships, about sexuality, about what is an appropriate, you know, what are appropriate forms of sexuality, what are, you know, good ways of having relationships. You know, certainly, you know, TBLG people do tend to have different ideas about, you know, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? And, you know, what does it mean to be a family?
Similar with atheism.
So it's not exactly the same. There's differences, but there's a lot of similarities there as well.
I think when you come out as an atheist, or when you, not even when you come out as an atheist, when you come to that conclusion, it changes your relationship. and you mentioned this in the beginning of the book, and it was a part that I particularly enjoyed, the idea that it changes your relationship with life. Because you're no longer thinking about there's something after I die. You're no longer thinking about your life as something that is infinite. It is now finite. And how do you deal with that finite life? And that was, I think, something I grappled with a lot when I reached that conclusion.
Greta, I really liked in the middle of the book talking a lot about, it was in the section of terrible things, but talking about mental illness and depression and the intersection between those and humanism, and you had a part where you talk about how when the religious are suffering, they feel punished, whereas atheists kind of realize it's statistics. And I like that a lot, because I think that obviously more of my friends are non-religious and atheist than religious. And I think I've seen that in my friends who struggle when life is just shitting on you nonstop. They don't feel like they did something to deserve it, whereas, you know, I'm a religious person might. But I specifically wanted to talk about, you talked about the sense of self and how recovery can be on you when it comes to mental illness, and how when you are an atheist or a humanist or however you want to label it, you can't just give that over to a higher power and be like, well, I'm still sick because God didn't fix me yet. And it there is a lot more self reliance in that. And I experienced that tenfold when I was in the hospital. So I really appreciated those chapters. I think they're going to help a lot of people who might not realize that there's a different component. You don't just have to wait for someone to fix you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that, because I've done a lot of writing about depression and mental illness, because I suffer from depression, and I certainly had, to some extent, runs in my family, and I know have lots of friends who do, mm-hmm. And there are these differences. It's a really perfect example of what is different about your life if you don't believe in God or an afterlife, and yes, it's definitely true what you say, that I don't feel like I'm being punished, and I don't feel like, what did I do wrong? I don't feel like it's some sort of weird test. There's a lot of religious believers, and I had this when I was a believer. It's like, oh, I'm being tested, or there's some lesson I'm supposed to learn.
Right.
But it's really obscure. It's like whatever I'm trying to be taught, it's like PhD level quantum physics, and I feel like I'm in third grade. You know,
I don't have a professor, or my professor doesn't actually come to the room, and he's just left some notes on the table at the front of the room that everybody has to go from, and the notes aren't actually about quantum physics. They're
right.
About zoology.
They're allegory.
Yeah.
Yes, and they're allegorical. They were written 3,000 years ago in Sumerian or whatever. So that is, you know, and I feel like that is, on the whole, a big advantage. I would much rather just go, look, this is brain chemistry. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of reasons for it. Some of it is genetic. Some of it is early childhood influences. Some of it's just what's going on in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I have this episodic depression, so it comes and goes. And when things in my life are terrible, that's when it tends to crop up. And it's much more comforting to know that. Also, it means I can do something useful about it.
Yes.
I'm not sitting around waiting for God to fix it.
Or praying.
And I'm not sort of trying to figure out, okay, what rituals do I have to do to make God fix it?
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, it's brain chemistry, and it's a problem, and it's a real, and it's even once you accept that there's no God involved, it's still a very knotty problem. It's one that I can do something about.
It's like in the uses of irrationality and limitations. You're talking about, you know, science as a methodology. You know, can be flawed, but like with time, it fixes and improves itself. And you know, like science, bad things have been done in the name of science and all that as well. But at the same time, like after the intuitively gathering, you know, religious ideas for years and years and years, that hasn't been honed. There's not like a body of religious knowledge that is doing better things now than it was like 5,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago or whatever. They can't even come to consensus about whether or not what's real and what's not religiously. And like no one's figured out a more, practical way of causing miracles to happen. Yeah. Like no one's honed that.
Way of praying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Leads me to one of my favorite chapters. Chapter 39 about mocking religion. I paid particular attention to this one because obviously, you know, we're a comedy podcast, an atheist podcast, so we mock religion plenty. And you make a lot of really great points, which are, you know, you kind of break it down like, you know, what's the difference between mocking religion and mocking religious people? Like, for example, Catholicism is foolish and Catholics are fools. The
yes.
difference there being that, you know, you're not that one is a flawed argument because Catholics, not all Catholics are fools, obviously, because that's just as bad as saying, you know, anything racist. You're right. Categorically making a decision about a group of people
it's judging ideas versus judging people.
Right.
Right.
And you talk a little bit, and I would love to, if you could talk a little bit, because I know our listeners are obviously the kind of people that appreciate mocking religion. Talk a little bit about where you think that mocking religion is actually a useful thing and how it can actually, it has societal benefit.
Sure. And I think that yes, I absolutely think mocking religion has a very important place. I think we need to be careful with it. And I talk about that a little bit in this chapter about when to do it and how to do it. But mockery always is a powerful tool when you're dealing with really powerful ingrained institutions, and especially really powerful ingrained institutions that take themselves very seriously and whose power sort of comes from that self-seriousness. You know, it's like so much of what makes religion powerful is that sense that it's, you know, that gravitas that it has and that sense that, oh, you shouldn't make fun of it. And, you know, this is like this deep, important issue of, you know, God and it's, you know, God will not be mocked. And, well, ha ha, I point and laugh at you, God, who doesn't exist.
It's the ultimate punching up.
Right. That's a really good way of, oh, I wish I'd thought of that for the book. Exactly. except it's punching up at somebody who doesn't exist. So
right, that's true. Yeah.
And, you know, we have, you know, it's not even just in the United States, there's a millennia-old tradition of making fun of powerful people and powerful institutions as a way of bringing them down a peg, as a way of cutting them down to size and making them seem human and, you know, sort of deflating that self-importance a little bit. So I do think that that's hugely important. That being said, when it's more of like a personal thing, and this is a distinction I draw in this chapter, is I think that there's a real difference between what you do in like a public forum. Like, you know, if you're Stephen Colbert, if you're, you know, Julia Sweeney, if you're, you know, if you're a podcaster, if you're the Geeks Without God, if you're, it's sort of your job in this public forum, in the marketplace of ideas to critique religion and have mockery be part of that. But, you know, if it's your cousin Cindy who's over for dinner,
Cindy down a peg.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, boy, Cindy's just Cindy really gets too full of herself.
Exactly. And to some degree, I mean, if it's you're over at Cindy's house for Thanksgiving and she's making everybody pray for 20 minutes while the turkey gets cold, maybe say something casually. There's no point in... There's no point in being like, this is fucking stupid, your religion is garbage, and I want to eat now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's a conversation to have with Cousin Cindy if she's making everybody pray for 20 minutes. But it's not like making fun of her is necessarily going to be, unless it's like if you and Cindy have, that's your relationship, and you have this sort of long history of joshing each other. But if it's not that, then also there's a thing about, that I talk about how, is it a social situation where people feel trapped? It's like if it's around the dinner table, it's very hard to just get up and walk away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you're being made fun of at the dinner table, it's really hard. Basically, your choices are start an argument, get up and walk away, which is really hard to do in that situation, or just sit there and let yourself be made fun of.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like that's fair. So I do think that mockery definitely has a place, but I think that that doesn't mean that it's every place.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I write a blog every week about things that annoy me. Shit that pisses me off. And I do talk about religion a lot, but I have a lot of readers who are religious and who aren't. And, you know, so I'm very careful. If it's like something stupid that's done by the Catholic Church, you know, I choose my words carefully. I talk about the Catholic Church. And I talk about how it is the church that is the problem and not Catholics themselves who are the problem. Now, that's not entirely true, because certainly Catholics themselves allow the church to continue to function in this fashion. But that's not really going to the point that needs to be made at that point. You know, when I talk about Christians and I talk about right-wing Christians, I'm very careful to talk about, even though you can argue that even left-wing Christians have some issues that need to be addressed, if it's the right-wing Christians that are the problem, I'm very careful to use to identify the group that I'm talking about, so you don't fall into this issue of people saying, well, not all Christians. I know that.
Right.
I know it's not all Christians. I know it's this specific group of Christians, and that's why I'm being really careful to say I'm talking about this specific group of Christians, and still mocking them, because that's kind of the point of the blog. But being careful to identify what I'm mocking, not the people, but the institution.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
And you do make a good point that it's not always easy to make that distinction, because, you know, the church, arguably, the church is the people and the people are the church. You know, the Catholic Church wouldn't exist if it weren't for, you know, millions of people who show up at Mass all the time. So it's a little, you know, it's not like it's a super clear-cut distinction. And I do think it's worth criticizing religious believers for if they are perpetuating bad ideas. It's just that I try to be more careful about it. And I, you know, it's like I will point and laugh at the Pope or at, you know, Rick Warren or, you know, whatever televangelist is, you know, making a fool of themselves this week. I will happily do that because they're powerful public figures.
They're choosing this life. No part of this is just them trying to live their life as a regular person and keep their head down and just be loved and love in return. These are people who are preying on the religious and using it to their own financial goals.
Right, exactly. Whereas if I'm talking with on the ground Catholics, and I've written about this, I've wrote a piece that was called "Why Are You Still Catholic?" and it was specifically about the child rape scandals, and it was about why are you supporting an institution that in which this problem is endemic, in which it is. You know,
that's a legitimate question to ask,
but I didn't use, I don't think, I have to now I'm like going, oh God, did I make fun of people in that piece? But I don't think I did. It was a very serious piece. It was saying, look, I trust your intelligence.
Yeah.
Why the fuck are you doing this?
Explain to me how you're able to, and again, that's the, you know, toward the beginning of the book, you talk about, you know, the concept of evil is altogether divorced from self. Like no one sees themselves as evil. Even, you know, let's just go full Godwin. And even Hitler thought he was doing the right thing by cleansing the world of the Jews. And, you know, everyone, that there's nothing worse than a villain who thinks that he's doing the right thing. And most people don't look at what they do. Even, you know, we've had friends recently who had terrible betrayals in their lives, and the person doing the betraying is like sees themselves as the victim. They still are like, oh, I don't know why you guys think I'm so bad. I'm not bad. I just did these things, and
I just couldn't help myself.
Or for whatever reason. Yeah, and I think that it's important to make people to hold that mirror up like you're doing. You know, to say, look, you know, you don't feel like that your religion is evil. It's excusing all this. So how do you agree with that?
Yeah, and yet we also have to be willing to hold that mirror up to ourselves. And
absolutely,
it is one of the things that, you know, once you accept that there's no God and no devil, and there's no heaven and there's no hell, and that this line between good and evil is not a sharp, bright line that's very easy to draw, we have to look at evil It's like it's – and we still do that even in secular culture. It's like you look at, you know, most, you know, action movies or whatever. Not even action movies. It's like there's good guys and there's bad guys. You know, there's good people and there's bad people. Mm-hmm. And that's not reality.
We like the world binary. That's just how we are. That's one of the reasons people struggle so hard with transgender issues and non-binary gender and all of that is our brains are wired to do an either or. That's
to
just,
do an – yeah. Yeah. It's how we're wired, and it's easier to think that way, mm-hmm. but it's really dangerous, I think, especially when it comes to good and evil, to say evil is – it's almost like it's a substance out there, and there's some people who are tainted with the substance mm-hmm. and some people who aren't, and even secular people tend to do this.
Absolutely.
And I think it's really important to think of evil as, look, this is something we do, and it's something we all do. We all do bad things, and – it's much more of a spectrum. Even that's a little simplistic, but it's a little more accurate. It's much more of a spectrum. Any given choice we make is going to be on a spectrum between doing the right thing and doing the wrong thing. It's always nuanced and it's always complicated. And if we don't accept that and we're not willing to like hold up that mirror, not just to other people but to ourselves, and we're not questioning our actions, then that makes it much more likely that we are going to do the wrong thing and then rationalize it rather than, you know, if we're willing to question, is this the right thing? I think we are more willing to, more able to make better choices. Unless we're completely, you know, frozen and can't make any choices because we're like facing, oh my gosh, there's no way to do the right thing. Yeah. So I'm just going to sit here quietly in amber and not ever do anything. Except that, of course, that's not the right choice either.
You talk about holding up a mirror, and one of the things I really liked was when you're talking about how skepticism very naturally plays into social justice. And I feel like a lot of people who have, you know, dismissed like any sort of a new atheism or atheism plus style, you know, social justice with your atheism approach, I feel like these are chapters that I would recommend for these people very specifically to get across the idea that evidence-based thinking about things like racial profiling or children raised in same-sex relationships or racial biases or, you know, sexism, like skepticism those things should be like the natural enemy of skepticism. Because they're bullshit, like because there's no evidence to support them, therefore they should be like examined thoroughly and cast aside. Like
To jump on that too, what's interesting to me is the concept that you arrive at the conclusion of atheism, and if you don't realize how that impacts the social justice question, it's like you reached a logical conclusion, then stopped and said, well, that's all I need to analyze and I'm done.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense. If you've made it that far, then you should naturally progress to the next step.
There's a quote in the book that's, of all the arguments for skepticism, not getting swindled by con artists is high on the list. I really like that a lot. And I think that if you look at any of these, like any great social injustice, that's all it is. It's specific groups of people being swindled by the man or by, mm-hmm. you know, systems of disenfranchisement.
Absolutely.
And like, it's just a different kind of swindling. Like it's no different than, you know, the shell game, but on a much larger scale.
And with all of us participating in it. Well, and I agree with you sort of for a couple of reasons. One is that I do think that once you conclude that there are no gods and that this world is all there is, as you say, there is this next obvious conclusion, which is this life is all there is. If there's going to be justice, we're the ones who have to make it. There's no pie in the sky when you die. If you are born into terrible poverty and despair and you die at age 13, that's it. You know, you don't get, you know, it's not okay because God is putting you in heaven and there's no plan. It's not like, well, this is all going to turn out in the end because it's God's plan. There's no plan. This is it. We're making it. And so it's our responsibility to make it right. And I also do think that, you know, skepticism, the sort of the evidence-based thinking, you know, using good analytical skills and so on, we have this tendency to think that skepticism means a certain set of subjects about which skepticism can be applied. You know, it's like, you know, Chupacabra and the Loch Ness Monster and astrology. And somehow it's okay to apply it to things like, you know, vaccine denialism or even global warming. And yet those somehow, that which are both political issues, and yet applying evidence-based thinking and good thinking and reasoning skills and, you know, willingness to question and reevaluate your ideas to things like the drug war, to policing practices, to the, you know, existence of endemic sexism and racism, unconscious personal sexism and racism, and also structural sexism and racism, you know, to the question of, you know, to questions about, you know, things like, you know, do same-sex couples who adopt children, do the children come out horribly warped? And, you know what, Week? That's a question with an answer. And the answer is no. You know? The answer is no more than anybody else. I mean, we all turn out warped. But so it's weird to me when skeptics say we can apply skepticism to these issues but not to those issues. Yeah. And really kind of what it comes down to is some of it's just territorial and some of it is, and there's this little tiny bit of sympathy that I have, which is that once you accept that we don't live in a just world, once you accept that we live in a world where racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, classism, ageism, all kinds of isms exist, and once we accept that we are, then that's also a conclusion that has implications, and the implications are that that you have to do something about it.
Absolutely. So Way of the Heathen, when will Way of the Heathen be released?
Way of the Heathen is being published on June 1st, and that is in print, in ebook, and in audiobook. And the audiobook is read by me. If you love the dulcet sounds of my voice, then you'll love the audiobook.
That's fantastic. So when this episode goes up, it's available now. So please, guys, run out and buy Way of the Heathen from Pitchstone Publishing. Greta, real quick, I just wanted to ask you, you have a new blog network?
Yes, I am currently blogging on The Orbit, which is a atheist social justice blogging collective that I'm one of the founders of, and I'm super proud of it. And there's a lot of really good bloggers on it. I'm really excited about it. So people should check it out. It's awesome. The Orbit,
the-orbit. The-orbit.com or .org? I think we lost it.
.net.
Up there, .net. There it is.
.net.
All right.
And I know that Stephanie Zvon.
Okay.
And Brianne Bilyeu, Jason Thibault. Yeah.
Friends of the show.
Friends of the show are on there, so.
All right. Hey, let's time. Let's get down to five questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. It's time to answer our new five questions, and we'll start with Tim and question one.
Great. All right. What is a movie that you will stop and watch anytime it's on, recognizing that that means something different now than it might have meant 5 years ago?
Right. I do still occasionally surf. And when I saw that question, there was an answer that immediately popped into my mind. And it's interesting because it's a movie that I actually have a lot of problems with. But it's a very good movie. It's a very compelling movie. It's really well made. It's really entertaining. And even the problems that I have with it sort of make me have to think. And that movie is The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh. I love that. Have you read that book?
I've not read the book.
The book is fantastic.
Is it? Okay.
I will check out the book. It's far better than the movie. The movie was great, but the book is goddamn amazing.
Okay. I will check out the book. And there's things that I really find frustrating about the movie. I think that there's a lot of sexist assumptions in it, but it's thoughtful and it's so just gorgeous and funny and well made. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's. I read that book a while ago. I have an embarrassing chick lit habit. I love terrible murder books, and I love terrible, like, just I love any chick lit fiction. So I read that one. There's another one called The Second Assistant that's very similar and is also good.
Right, there's a great scene or a great like moment of dialogue in that movie where, the male fashion designer guy, mm-hmm. she's like, I don't get it. It's just clothes. This is bullshit. And he's like, do you know the story behind, like, this color green? And it's...
That's actually Meryl Streep.
It's Meryl Streep. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Why your sweater is that particular shade of green?
And it ties back to, like, military uniforms and some
things that were on the runway,
and...
like, a year and a half ago, and that spawned this, and this spawned that, and that inspired this, and all that down to your little shitty Kmart sweater.
I'm confusing it with a different conversation she has with the dude, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Meryl Streep. Yeah. It's such a great scene because it's like... I don't know. It's easy to dismiss things
that you don't personally,
that you don't understand, and that as like not being a lot of thought put into them. But it's I like that. Oh, question number two: what is your geekiest or most prized possession?
So that's a large category. So I don't know if this is most, but it's one that I'm going to pull out, and that is my collection of vintage and antique vibrators.
Oh, what? Awesome. That's amazing.
I have a handful. Most of them have been gifts from friends, and I have this handful of about half a dozen. One of them has a little sticker on it that says that it's from 1903. I don't know for sure if it's really that old, but I have some that are really old. I have some from like the 30s and 40s and 50s, and it just makes me so happy to have them.
Like hysteria cures?
Is it wind up?
Like,
or?
I'm picturing like you know those old crank egg beaters? I'm picturing like a hand crank that just pistons it up and down.
No, these are all plug-in. These are all sort of from the early days of, you know, when home electronics started to be a thing.
Does it have a cord?
Yep.
There's just something that to me is anathema about shoving something that's plugged in up into my twat. Like, that direct current does not sound like it's a smart decision.
It's kind of some serious, like, Road to Wellville kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they were... Like medical cures, right?
There's an interesting. If you want to read the book about it, there's a good book called The Technology of Orgasm, or I think that's what it's called, The Technology of Orgasm, The Technology of Pleasure, something like that. And it's about sort of the history of the vibrator, and it's fascinating. And you're right, it was originally invented as a hysteria cure and as a labor saving device for doctors who were having to take care of this manually in their office.
It's like she's causing all these problems. Well, she's much better now that she's had a few orgasms. She seems just much happier with life.
Better after a few orgasms. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
Who isn't? Right? Who has an orgasm that is like, man, things are worse? I mean, I guess it depends on where you orgasmed and with whom, but still.
People who get pregnant afterwards? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
All right. Question number three. What mythological, supernatural, or otherwise not real deity thing do you wish were real?
Okay, so I had to think about this for a while because my initial reaction is none of them. I don't, in fact, want gods to exist because they would have way too much power. That is too much power for any one being to have. So I narrowed it down. In the Terry Pratchett books, there's a goddess named, I think it's pronounced Anoia, and she is the goddess of things that get stuck in drawers. And I'm like, you know, that's okay. That is a reasonable amount of power to have. If somebody has to be supernatural... You can help me get things unstuck out of drawers.
That's
not too much power.
And like worst case scenario, you anger the god and it's like, I just can't get these damn scissors out of here. Like, oh. Exactly. Like that's your smiting.
No wars, no famine. All everyone's scissors are stuck.
Exactly. And the spatula gets bent and you know, it's like, you know, what hath God wrought?
Okay, question number four. Say religion is gone. What is the biggest problem that now faces humanity?
Yeah. I hate to say it, but I think this is an easy one, and it's global climate change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, global climate change is like, and there's a lot, and I thought about it. It's like, you know, racism and misogyny and, you know, all these things, you know, horrible economic disparity, and all those are all important too. But if we don't get global climate change handled, game over. Nothing else is going to matter. Everything is going to suck for a really long time, and then it's going to be gone. And so I would have to say that.
The other problems aren't as catastrophically urgent.
Yeah.
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 Sure.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
Question number five, our last question. What is your favorite quote?
So this is one actually that I talk about in the book, and it's a quote that I came across many years ago. And I don't know if this is the exact correct translation because the original is in like it's like zero century Hebrew.
Sure.
but it's from the rabbi and philosopher Hillel. And the version of it that I heard that always stuck with me was, if I am not for myself, then who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, then who am I?
Mm.
And I really like that partly because that's the struggle of my whole life. That's the struggle of a lot of our whole lives, is we do have to take care of ourselves. We do have to look after ourselves because nobody else is going to do it. Mm. But if that's all we're doing, then our lives are meaningless. If we're only taking care of ourselves, then we have no meaning and no value to our lives. And it's always a balance, and it's a balance in every different situation. And that's another reason I like it, is that a lot of aphorisms are very simple. It's like, do this thing, you know, it's do the thing and then things will be all right. And I like this one because it's the whole point of the aphorism is that things aren't simple and that living a good life is a matter of balance.
Absolutely. That's a great place to end on. That was wonderful. Greta, thank you so much. Greta Christina, author of The Way of the Heathen from Pitchstone Publishing, longtime guest on the show. I'm glad to have had you back. This was really great to talk to you.
That was so good to talk with you. I'm really glad we were able to do this.
Please go out and buy The Way of the Heathen. It's available now in all sorts of forms. And you can listen to Greta as the narrator if you'd like. Is it on Audible?
It's on Audible, yes.
Audible, Amazon, bookstores near you. So anyway, we are Geeks Without God. This has been a fun Skype conversation. If you want to donate to our Patreon to help us get better equipment to do more Skype calls like this and to maybe actually have better remote recording capabilities, please visit us on patreon.com, right? Yeah.
Patreon.com/geekswithoutgod.
/geekswithoutgod. Follow us on Facebook, like us on Twitter, or reverse that, whichever it is. I don't even care anymore, guys.
Do the social media thing.
Social media is so hard. Thank you and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I love this book. It's about a hot chicken. The Way of the Heathen.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
Need more Geeks Without God? Go to our website, read our blog posts, find us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Geeks Without God. Social media!
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We're geeks, geeks without God.
You'll get that gigantic Geeks Without God bump that no one's ever gotten before.